Word of mouth. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, a catch-22 for the long-term unemployed. Employers are far less likely to hire people who've been out of work for more than 6 months. We'll take a closer look at research revealing prejudice against those long without a job. Also today, recreational Adderall. Prescription stimulants are the new drug of choice among college students and getting plenty popular off campus. We'll talk to a journalist who thinks all the talk of an Adderall epidemic is overblown. But we begin with Brothers in Terrorism. The shock and horror of the Boston Marathon explosions 1 week ago today gave way to an almost incomprehensible sequence of events, leading to a dramatic day-long dragnet that shut down a major American city and several surrounding neighborhoods for a day. Now, with one suspect dead and his younger brother in critical condition at a Boston hospital, citizens and media alike grapple to understand their motivations and levels of organization. Among the most combed-over questions is whether 26-year-old Tamerlan Tsarnaev somehow radicalized his popular, athletic, seemingly well-adjusted 19-year-old brother, Zohar. It turns out that the history of terrorism is rife with pairs of siblings operating together, not the least of which were three pairs of brothers among the 19 9/11 hijackers. Dr. John Horgan is director of the International Center for the Study of Terrorism at Penn State. He's also author of The Psychology of Terrorism. He and his colleague Mia Bloom wrote a primer on terrorist siblings that was posted on the center's site this Saturday. Dr. Horgan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
Now, anyone following your Twitter feed last week would see several cautions against coming up with premature narratives. But how about for you? You were watching the news of the Boston Marathon explosions. What were your immediate thoughts on who or what was behind the attack?
I think I shared many of those same cautions. I was actually in the UK, believe it or not, at a counterterrorism workshop when I saw the events, news of the events pour in. And I think I really was surprised at the sheer frenzied nature of the reporting last week. And I mean, I understand and accept that some of that is to be expected. But I think my reaction when I was in the UK was that it just doesn't bode well for how resilient we are supposed to be in the wake of events like this. What worried me wasn't so much how some cable news networks covered the events, but the fact that so many myths were perpetuated on just about every aspect of the attack. There were lots of, I think, quite irresponsible things said about not just the perpetrators, their psychology, but about terrorism itself. Especially worrying was the narrative, I suppose, that attacks like this can be prevented. Many attacks can be prevented. Many terrorist attacks can be foiled, especially when they involve multiple actors, multiple moving parts. But I think small-scale attacks like this represent terrorism at its worst in the 21st century, and I think these attacks are next to impossible to predict, especially when there are elements of training and elements of practice that go into the preparation of these events.
Well, let's talk about these two that we know. We know so much more about them than we did a week ago today, obviously. First of all, the fact that they were brothers. Now, you talked about levels of training. Anything that we can take from the idea that they were brothers. And indeed, what we know now, you know, a lot of terror organizations employ siblings.
Yes, they do. And it's actually quite, it's something far more common than I think people assume. But and I should caution what I'm about to say by saying we don't yet know if there is a broader group or organizational context to this. But in examples of nationalist or ethnically oriented terror groups, it's very, very common for pairs of siblings to become involved. And it's actually something that's quite preferable from the perspective of a terrorist recruiter.
Why would that be?
Well, think about the kinds of things that recruiters and organizations worry about. I mean, engaging family members is a very, very, it's almost like a shortcut way for sustaining the commitment of the siblings. It also serves, of course, to heighten operational security. We've seen many examples, particularly from the Chechen case, of sibling suicide bombers where each sibling ensures basically that the other is less likely to either change their mind at the last minute, which we often see, or worse again, even inform on the group to the authorities. We've interviewed many terrorist recruiters and security officers within terrorist organizations over the years, and they tell us time and time again, we spend as much time worrying about infiltration as we do worrying about thinking about what the next operation might be.
Hmm. Forrest Wickham, writing in Slate, points to what counterterrorism experts term an older brother figure in many terrorist groups. Now, what role does this older brother figure serve?
I think it's very, very plausible that this idea that the older brother essentially serves to groom or to indoctrinate or whatever term we want to use the younger brother. But I would just urge a little bit more caution there and say let's wait for the facts to emerge. It's plausible, but I would prefer to wait to see the evidence. We've often seen this assumption that there must be some kind of a master and apprentice relationship, but we've seen examples whereby that dynamic isn't so clear cut, where it was actually the younger sibling who was pulling the strings, if you like.
Mm.
And in some research we've recently finished on the reemergence of some Irish splinter terrorist group, we've seen several examples of twins. So it's not as clear cut as it might initially seem. But time will tell.
We're talking with Dr. John Horgan. He's director of the International Center for the Study of Terrorism and author of several books on the psychology of terrorism. Well, let's look more at this younger brother, Zohar. He's being called alternately. Suspect number two, the white hat suspect, he was known as on Thursday night. Incomprehensible to his classmates at Cambridge Ringe in Latin that he could possibly be the same one, you know, the same person who could commit these atrocities. He goes back to his dorm at UMass Dartmouth on Wednesday, works out, kind of resuming his routine. What does that kind of behavior tell you about him in particular?
It tells me that there isn't necessarily an element of training in this, but there certainly are elements of practice, of control, of poise. I mean, they clearly have worked this out in terms of what to expect in before the event, during the event, and immediately after the event. I wouldn't want to speculate about what it hypothetically might have meant vis-a-vis future attacks, but there certainly is a very strong element of control that went into trying to reduce his, signaling suspicious behavior. I've heard a lot of commentary in the news over the last several days that we need to get better at identifying terrorism before it happens. We need to get better at identifying the suspicious behavior that terrorists leak, if you like. I think we're barking up the wrong tree as far as that's concerned. I mean, there are some kinds of terrorists, particularly lone actors, who tend to leak, who tend to talk to people around them and talk about their plans, talk about their grievances. This seems very, very different. This seems like there is a very strong level of commitment. It seems like there's poise, there's control, and they really knew what they were doing.
I've seen a lot of bandying around of terms like that words like disaffected, disappointed, lone wolf, stray dogs. Is there anything such a thing as a terrorist profile, Dr. Horgan?
Well, that's the $64 million question, Virginia. There's good news and there's bad news. I mean, let me give you the bad news first. No, there is no terrorist profile. There's no personality. There's no checklist. And your listeners can abandon all hope of getting a terrorist profile right now. The academic community has been looking for one for 40 years, and I don't think we're going to get one anytime soon. The good news, however, is that we've started to shift our focus away from profiles and onto the pathways that terrorists take. And we started to make a lot of progress in this area. We've looked at the kinds of ideas that would-be terrorists have about what awaits them in a group, what actually motivates them as opposed to what we assume motivates them. In some cases, I mean, it's the usual stuff. It's ideology, it's religion, it's outrage at the actions of or inactions of government. It might be outrage over a foreign occupation or the kinds of victimization that goes along with that. Realistically, it's often some complicated combination of those things, but those tend to be motivational factors at the higher level. Some of the research that we've been involved in here has been looking at some of the more individual level reasons for becoming involved. And those things have far more to do with hopes of glory, excitement, camaraderie, adventure. And in some cases, you know, those things start to hold a lot more appeal if you don't have very much going on in your life.
I've been reading a number of op-eds and sometimes social media posts over the past few days from people who are saying something akin to, yeah, I don't want to hear about what led Zohar and his brother to do this. You know, why is it important, or is it important to understand the motivations of a terrorist? And when are we in the media maybe giving them undue levels of attention by trying to understand those motivations, by trying to get inside of the head of somebody who would do something like this?
I've heard these same comments, and I mean, I'm sympathetic to where the sentiment is coming from. But I think, and this is a lesson I often try to impart to my students, understanding is not the same thing as excusing. And I think those issues have really been confounded in recent times. Understanding is about getting a sense of the kinds of things that these terrorists go through in their preparations. It's about understanding as much how they do what they do as opposed to why they do what they do. I mean, one of the most disheartening things here, and we've got a lot of evidence of this from the terrorists that we've interviewed over the years, in some cases, the terrorists themselves don't necessarily have a clear idea about what we're doing. So it is important to get a sense of what lures them in, what attracts them to either individual courses of action or individual groups or organizations, because having that knowledge will allow us to demythologize what these guys think is awaiting for them once they start to become involved.
John Horgan, director of the International Center for the Study of Terrorism. He's also associate professor of psychology and affiliate professor of international affairs at Pennsylvania State University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always happy to support public radio. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. He's written a number of books on the psychology and strategies of terrorism. Also, he's been working quite a bit on disengaging and, quote unquote, rehabilitating terrorists. So there's a lot to read about, and we do have links for more at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, bad news for the long-term unemployed. We'll get into some of the research showing some prejudice against people who've been out of work for a long time when word of mouth continues in just a few minutes.